for this January 19th. This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. And here are some of your Tuesday headlines. President-elect Joe Biden is spending the night at Blair House across from the White House on the eve of his inauguration. His morning tomorrow will begin with services at St. Matthew's Cathedral. He will be joined by House and Senate leaders, Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democratic Senate leader Chuck Schumer, Republican leader Mitch McConnell, and House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy. That is significant because it means the congressional Republican leadership will not be with outgoing President Trump during his farewell ceremony at Joint Base Andrews. Also skipping President Trump's last official event while in office, his vice president, Mike Pence. His office saying it is logistically difficult to be at the ceremony and at the inaugural ceremonies on the west front of the U.S. Capitol later in the morning. We, of course, will be covering all of the day's events live on C-SPAN, and you can listen to it here on C-SPAN Radio. Also today, with heightened security across the nation's capital, a dozen National Guard members have been removed from inauguration duty. Security officials are concerned that some service members had possible sympathies to anti-government groups. The Capitol, White House, and other locations around the Federal Triangle remain in lockdown tonight. It is the tightest security ever for a presidential inauguration. And the U.S. has passed another sad milestone. 400,000 deaths from COVID-19. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, the U.S. is now averaging more than 3,000 coronavirus deaths every day. To put that into perspective, Japan, with a population of approximately 127 million people, has had an overall death toll of just over 4,500. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. We begin on Capitol Hill in the Senate with the confirmation hearings for five of the Biden cabinet nominees. But Republican Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri is objecting to Alejandro Mayorkas, blocking his nomination for a quick confirmation to head up the Department of Homeland Security. The Missouri senator is objecting to the president-elect's immigration policies. And the Senate Finance Committee, hearing from Treasury Secretary-designate Janet Yellen, will have highlights just ahead. But first, today's Senate floor speech by Republican leader Mitch McConnell. He addressed the chamber for the first time since Congress voted to certify the Electoral College results. That, of course, was the same day supporters of the president breaching security, storming the Capitol, which left five people dead and debris throughout the U.S. Capitol. Senator McConnell putting some of the blame squarely on President Trump.
The mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. And they tried to use fear and violence to stop a specific proceeding of the first branch of the federal government, which they did not like. But we pressed on. We stood together and said an angry mob would not get veto power over the rule of law in our nation, not even for one night. We certified the people's choice for their 46th president. Tomorrow, President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris will be sworn in. We'll have a safe and successful inaugural right here on the west front of the Capitol, the space that President Bush 41 called democracy's front porch. And then we'll move forward. Our work for the American people will continue as it has for more than 230 years. There are serious challenges that our nation needs to continue confronting. But there will also be great and hopeful opportunities for us to seize. Certainly, November's elections did not hand any side a mandate for sweeping ideological change. Americans elected a closely divided Senate, a closely divided House, and a presidential candidate who said he'd represent everyone. So our marching orders from the American people are clear. We're to have a robust discussion and seek common ground. We are to pursue bipartisan agreement everywhere we can and check and balance one another respectfully where we must. And through all of this, we must always keep in mind that we're all Americans. We all love this country, and we're all in this together.
That from the soon-to-be Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Three new Democratic senators will be sworn in tomorrow afternoon, resulting in a 50-50 makeup of the U.S. Senate, with Kamala Harris as the incoming vice president able to break any ties. We'll get some background on that story just ahead. But first, the Democratic Senate leader, Chuck Schumer, from earlier today.
The Senate returns to session today for what will be a very busy and consequential period. Tomorrow, we will celebrate one of democracy's core attributes, the peaceful transfer of power, albeit under much different circumstances than most Americans are used to. Rioters, insurrectionists, white supremacists, and domestic terrorists tried to prevent the transfer of power. They were incited by none other than the President of the United States. They have failed. Though they have made the transition of power anything but peaceful, democracy's oldest and most revered tradition, the peaceful passing of the torch, will take place tomorrow. We must remain vigilant. We must remain strong. If we do, democracy will always prevail. Despite what these evil terrorists tried to do, the peaceful passing of the torch will take place tomorrow, as it has for generations. In the weeks since the attack, the nation has learned about the heroism displayed by many Capitol Police officers on January 6. And I want to again thank those officers who protected members and staff. Let us also recognize the bravery of one officer in particular, Brian Sicknick, who was killed in the line of duty. I also want to acknowledge those members of the Fourth Estate for their efforts during these difficult times, for continuing to shine a light on what was happening at the Capitol, sometimes at great personal risk. Now, in the wake of the despicable assault on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, we have taken precautions to ensure the safety of the inauguration of President-elect Biden tomorrow.
That from the Senate floor earlier today. Joining us on the phone is John Bresnahan. He is the co-founder of the new site, punchbowl.news. We thank you for being with us. I want to begin with your reaction to those comments earlier today on the floor by the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, with, we should point out, Senator Ted Cruz presiding at that moment over the U.S. Senate.
Yeah, it was a pretty extraordinary statement by McConnell. He went to the floor and he said, I mean, this is his quote, the mob was fed lies. They were provoked by the president and other powerful people. And, you know, he was clearly laying the blame, or at least part of the blame, for the January 6th attack on the Capitol at Trump's feet. And the other people, he didn't mention Cruz by name, but Cruz was there, who played into the president's refusal to accept Joe Biden's election as president of the United States, and, you know, Trump's defeat and Joe Biden's election, and then certification as president-elect of the United States.
With two new Democratic senators from Georgia and a Democratic senator replacing Kamala Harris, it is a 50-50 Senate as of tomorrow. So walk us through the structure of the new Senate in this evenly divided chamber.
So what will happen tomorrow is that Biden and Harris will be sworn in as president and vice president, respectively. At that point, we expect then Vice President Harris to swear in Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, and then from Georgia, and then Alex Padilla from California. That will give the Democrats 50 senators, and with Harris as vice president, that will give them control. They will be in the majority of the Senate. Chuck Schumer will become the Senate majority leader. McConnell will move from majority leader back to minority leader. He was minority leader previously. He will now return to that role after 6 years. How it's going to work is still up in the air because the Senate has not organized for the 117th Congress. McConnell and Schumer met today to discuss this issue. They met to discuss the upcoming impeachment trial for what will be former President Donald Trump after tomorrow. And they didn't say a lot coming out of that meeting. Schumer just said they talked about a lot of issues and he wasn't going to say anything else. We're trying to get some more information on what's going on. So right now, the Senate does not have an organizational power sharing agreement on how it's going to operate. So what happens is that the Senate can function. It can take up issues, but everything has to be done by unanimous consent, which means any of 100 senators can block any movement on anything. So they're going to have to work that out, and then they're going to have to come to some kind of agreement on how they're going to handle the Trump trial.
What are you hearing in terms of the start date for the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate?
That is still, this is not something that has not been decided. Now, when Speaker Pelosi gives the article of impeachment to the Senate or sends it to the Senate, then they're supposed to start the next day. They're in session in any day other than Sunday. My anticipation is that I don't know what's going to happen this week, if she's going to send that over. I'm not sure that Schumer is ready for it, or McConnell, that they're ready for it. They could accept the agreement, and then they could stall a little bit. You know, they could say, well, we're starting a trial, we're in the early preparatory phase. They could, there's lots of ways they can fudge it a little bit, but sooner or later, they're going to have to decide how they handle it, or, you know, how long is it going to be? Who, you know, the president's, we have House impeachment managers have been appointed. Who's going to represent the president in the trial, his defense team? Does the president or the managers, are they going to be allowed to call witnesses? Is that something the Senate wants to set aside on deciding that question about and let the both sides present their case first? And then, you know, they have a test vote and see where they are. And, you know, maybe they go to witnesses or additional evidence is introduced, or maybe they go to the end of the case. I mean, it could, you know, they could decide, they could set up kind of a bifurcated process. They did that in the Clinton trial in 1998. They did that in the Trump's first impeachment trial. So, you know, that could be a template for what they do. But then it can do whatever he wants. Now, something that's very important here is Trump was not allowed, whatever you think about his role in January 6th, he was not allowed to offer any defense at all in the House impeachment proceeding. And he was not, his lawyers were not offered any opportunity to present his case. So I think there's clearly some due process concerns here. Trump, you know, if you're going to have a trial, you're going to have to let him offer his own take on what happened and what his role in the January 6th incident was. And so I think there's some concerns that he did not get a fair hearing in the House.
All of this chronicled online at punchbowl.news. We're talking with John Bresnahan, the co-founder of that new website. And I want to go back to three key power players, Democrats Joe Manchin and Republicans Susan Collins and Mitt Romney. As somebody who has covered Congress for so many years, how pivotal of a role will they play in the coming term?
Well, I think they're going to be key. All the moderates, all the, you know, on both sides of the aisle, have, and a 50-50 Senate, have enormous influence. I mean, Manchin is a conservative Democrat. You know, he's pro-life. He's not shy about it. He's already made clear he doesn't want to get rid of the legislative filibuster. He'll do deals with the Republicans. He has a very good working relationship with Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator from Alaska. She was chair of the Energy Committee last cycle, and he was the Democratic ranking Democrat. But they did everything together. Now the two roles are swapped, and I think he's going to be very inclusive on keeping her in the mix. I think Manchin wants to do things, and you know he knows he needs Republicans to do it, and he's going to push that. Now, Romney is an interesting case. He was the only Republican who voted to impeach Trump the first time around. So, you know, and he became a very vocal Trump critic. So, you know, I mean, there's so many Democrats didn't like, but, you know, I think he's gained a lot of respect on that side of the aisle now. And Susan Collins just got reelected, you know, after, you know, it was a tough campaign for her. She had a big win. And again, this is Collins, you know, likes to govern from the middle. I mean, she's center-right, and she wants to do, you know, she wants to move legislation. I think that all are very serious about some kind of COVID relief package, doing additional work on that, and anything else to need to do to stimulate the economy. And then from beyond there, I think, I think they'll try and move. I think there's some centrists who will try and move their own legislative agenda, whether it's on immigration or maybe some other issue. So I think they're, you know, the centrists are, I think there's some of them got fed up with being, you know, just jammed by their leadership throughout the Trump era. And I think you saw it at the end of the last Congress when they, you know, when the Problem Solvers Caucus and some of the moderates on both sides of the aisle, the centrists ended up cutting a deal, and we got a COVID relief package that had been hung up for months in discussions between the White House and the Senate and Democratic and Republican leadership in both the House and Senate. So I think centrists are going to be enormously important going forward, especially I can't emphasize this enough. January 6th was a watershed moment for a lot of people. And we did not, thankfully, have the loss of there were five people who were dead. You know, that was tragic. It wasn't a scale of a 9/11 event. But I think I've never seen the political establishment in Washington that rattled by anything, including 9/11, which was a shocking thing. I think this attack on the Capitol is in that league in terms of it's really shaking people up here. And, like, you know, there has to be a new paradigm. I think some people are feeling like we can't just go and lob these rhetorical bombs at each other and these partisan attacks on each other and then expect everybody, you know, not to, you know, not the mad passions not to get inflamed. There has to be some kind of consensus. I think that really, you know, there has to be some, you know, sober-minded folks on both the left and the right who come together and do some agreements, you know, don't have to get everything they want. They just have to do some agreements. They're, you know, if we keep going down this path, a country is a real problem. And I mean, it already does, but it could only get worse. And I think there's a lot of people here who see this as, you know, this is, we have to change how we operate. And this is the time and place to do it.
John Bresnahan is joining us on Capitol Hill. Congratulations on the new venture, punchbowl.news. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Now to the inauguration of Joe Biden as our 46th president. Before leaving his home state of Delaware this afternoon, he delivered remarks at the National Guard Reserve Center in Newcastle. It's a facility named after his late son, Beau. He died in 2015 after battling brain cancer at the age of 46.
As Tommy, or better known as Chairman Carper, Senator Carper, knows, my colleagues in the Senate used to always kid me for quoting Irish poets. They thought I did it because I'm Irish. I didn't do it for that reason. I did it because they're the best poets in the world. And James Joyce was said to have told a friend that when it comes his time to pass, when he dies, he said, Dublin will be written on my heart. Well, excuse the emotion, but when I die, Delaware will be written on my heart. And the hearts of all of us, all the Bidens, we love you all. You've been there for us in the good and the bad. You never walked away. And I am proud to be a son of Delaware. And I am even more proud to be standing here doing this from the Major Beau Biden facility. Ladies and gentlemen, I only have one regret. He's not here because we should be introducing him as president. But we have great opportunities. Delaware has taught us anything's possible. Anything's possible in this country. So God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. Thank you.
Joe Biden, the president-elect earlier today in Delaware before arriving in Washington for tomorrow's ceremony. Our live coverage gets underway at 7 a.m. Eastern time. Joe Biden will take the office at noon Eastern, 9 o'clock for our West Coast listeners. NBC News is reporting that the Biden speech will focus on American unity. He will discuss the need to bring the country together on the heels of the violent riots on Capitol Hill and amid extreme partisanship in Congress. Former Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Obama will be in attendance, along with Vice President Mike Pence. His inaugural address will be followed by a virtual parade, and in lieu of inaugural balls, the presidential committee will be hosting a primetime special. Actor Tom Hanks will lead a celebrity cast that includes singers Bruce Springsteen, Demi Lovato, and Jon Bon Jovi, as well as actresses Eva Longoria and Kerry Washington. That will be live on C-SPAN 2. You can listen to it here on C-SPAN Radio, beginning at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. The Senate Finance Committee, one of five congressional hearings for Biden cabinet nominees. Committee members hearing from the former Fed Chair Janet Yellen. She's been selected to be the Treasury Secretary. She told lawmakers that investing in vaccine distribution and expanding jobless benefits will provide what she called the biggest bang for the economy. But it comes with a hefty price tag, nearly $2 trillion, a massive proposal that is receiving opposition from Republicans who point to a growing federal debt. Here is a portion of her opening remarks.
When economists look back on the pandemic, I expect they'll conclude that Congress's actions averted a lot of suffering. But more must be done. Economists don't always agree, but I think there is a consensus now. Without further action, we risk a longer, more painful recession now and longer-term scarring of the economy later. The pandemic has caused widespread devastation. Whole industries have paused their work. 18 million unemployment insurance claims are being paid every week. Food bank shelves are going empty. The damage has been sweeping. And as the president-elect said last Thursday, our response must be too. Over the next few months, we're going to need more aid to distribute the vaccine, to reopen schools, to help states keep firefighters and teachers on the job.
Janet Yellen is the Treasury Secretary nominee. The nation's debt did double under 8 years during Barack Obama and doubled again in the last 4 years during the Trump presidency. As we approach a $28 trillion federal debt, this line of questioning from South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune.
For me, that is a huge warning sign on the horizon, the fact that we have an ever-growing deficit, an ever-growing debt, and no apparent interest in taking the steps that are necessary to address it.
Senator, I agree with you that it's essential that we put the federal budget on a path that's sustainable and that we're responsible and make sure that what we do with respect to deficits and debt leave future generations better off. But the most important thing, in my view, that we can do today to put us on a path of fiscal sustainability is to defeat the pandemic, to provide relief to American people, and then to make long-term investments that will help the economy grow and benefit future generations. To avoid doing what we need to do now to address the pandemic and the economic damage that it's causing would likely leave us in a worse place fiscally and with respect to our debt situation than taking the steps that are necessary and doing that through deficit finance. We really have to worry about scarring of due to this pandemic of workers and the loss of small businesses that can really harm the long-run potential productivity of our economy and leave us with long-run problems that would make it difficult to get back on the growth path that we were on.
From today's Senate Finance Committee and the nomination of Janet Yellen, she is Joe Biden's pick to be the next Treasury Secretary. Meanwhile, the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing from retired General Lloyd Austin to serve as the next Defense Secretary. If confirmed, the 67-year-old former Army officer would make history. He would become the first African-American to head up the Pentagon. His nomination will also require a Senate waiver because of his tenure in the military and his relatively recent retirement. He addressed that issue earlier today.
Let me say at the outset that I understand and respect the reservations that some of you have expressed about having another recently retired general at the head of the Department of Defense. The safety and security of our democracy demands competent civilian control of our armed forces, the subordination of military power to the civil. I spent my entire life committed to that principle. In war and in peace, I implemented the policies of civilians elected and appointed over me, leaders like Secretary Panetta. And I know that being a member of the President's cabinet, a political appointee, requires a different perspective and unique duties from a career in uniform. I intend to surround myself with and empower experienced, capable civilian leaders who will enable healthy civil-military relations grounded in meaningful oversight. Indeed, I plan to include the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in top decision-making meetings, ensuring strategic and operational decisions are informed by policy. I will rebalance collaboration and coordination between the Joint Staff and the OSD staff to ensure civilian input is integrated at every level of the process. And I will make clear my expectation that the Pentagon work hand in glove with the State Department supporting the work of our diplomats. Now, I know that a large measure of civilian control of our military lies right here with this body. And if you confirm me, I assure you that the Pentagon, under my leadership, will respect your oversight responsibilities, and we will be transparent with you. And I will provide you my best counsel, and I will seek yours.
Lloyd Austin is a former Army general. He is the nominee to head up the Pentagon as Defense Secretary for the incoming Biden administration. And Senate Republicans on the Homeland Security Committee pressing the president-elect's pick to head up the Department of Homeland Security. Lawmakers pointing to what they called Alejandro Mayorkas's, quote, troubling issues over how he handled the visa program for wealthy foreign investors during the Obama administration. Some tough questioning from Ohio Senator Rob Portman. The full hearing is available on our website at cspan.org. And there was another moment when outgoing Chair Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin questioning the nominee on how the new administration will handle the DACA program, as well as illegals still crossing into the U.S.
So I guess my questions for you is, Secretary Johnson, who you served under, said that 1,000 people per day was a bad day. We have been consistently over 2,000 a day for the last number of years, over 4,000 a day in March 2019. Right now we're back over 2,000 per day. Do you consider that a problem? What is going to be a bad day if you're Secretary of Department of Homeland Security of illegal entry?
Senator Johnson, I've had the privilege of addressing these issues with you before when I was served as the Deputy Secretary of Homeland Security and candidly, of course, several weeks ago when I became the nominee to be the next Secretary of Homeland Security. I look forward to studying the data with you and actually being open and transparent with you.
What will 1,000 a day be a bad day, or is 2,000 acceptable, is 3,000 acceptable? What's going to be a bad day on your watch?
Senator,
pick a number.
Senator, I look forward to...
Okay, I don't have time for... Okay, so next question. Do you believe coming into this country illegally for economic improvement, is that a valid asylum claim?
Senator, the asylum laws are well established, and they provide that an individual who is fleeing persecution by reason of his or her member in a particular social group is deserving of protection.
Okay, but coming here for economic gain is not a valid asylum claim. Would you agree with that?
Senator, I believe I articulated the legal theory.
Okay.
From today's Senate Homeland Security Committee hearing and the nomination of Alejandro Mayorkas to head up DHS, you're listening to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. It's also available as a podcast. Welcome back to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. On this eve of the presidential inauguration, here are some of your other headlines. The New York Times is reporting that domestic airfares dropping to their lowest level in at least the last 20 years. Many passengers able to get one-way domestic flights for as low as $135. It comes as air travel has plummeted this past year due to coronavirus. And the CEO of MyPillow, Mike Lindell, taking a business hit for his support of the president. A number of major retailers like Bed Bath & Beyond and Kohl's dropping his products after he made repeated false claims of voter fraud. In other news, Avril Haines is the president-elect's nominee for Director of National Intelligence. The Washington Post is writing that it may be among his least controversial picks. Introduced by Dan Coats, former Indiana senator, and President Trump's former director of national intelligence. She also received praise from both Republican Senator Marco Rubio and Democrat Mark Warner. Asked whether she viewed China as, quote, an adversary, Avril Haines explaining that Biden overall saw China as, quote, a global competitor, but in areas such as espionage and trade, it was an adversary. Here is Senator Mark Warner of Virginia.
This committee, over the years, under both the Obama administration and the Trump administration, has seen China move extraordinarily aggressively. The chairman made reference to their efforts to influence American policymakers. We see them move aggressively militarily. We see them move aggressively economically. I've been particularly concerned about their efforts to dominate new technologies. And we've seen them use tools from stealing intellectual property to treating their own people extraordinarily poorly, whether they be Uyghurs or the people of Hong Kong. So I think it is important that we are clear-eyed about China. I do think it's important as well to recognize that our beef is not with the Chinese people, but with this Chinese Communist Party. So I want to just ask you straight out, Ms. Haynes, is China under the rule of the Chinese Communist Party an adversary of the United States?
Thank you, Vice Chairman. I couldn't agree more with the priority that you're attaching to China and the need, I think, for the intelligence community to focus on this issue. I think in the context of China, China is adversarial and an adversary on some issues, and in other issues we try to cooperate with them, whether in the context of climate change or other things. And ultimately, the frame that the president-elect has identified for thinking about this is as a global competitor. But I think that doesn't, to your point, in any way mitigate the fact that when it comes to espionage or a variety of areas that I'll be focused on, if I am confirmed in the Director of National Intelligence, they are an adversary and that we have to work on those issues in particular, countering their illegal, unfair, aggressive actions in these spaces.
From today's confirmation hearing for the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines served as the Deputy CIA Director and the Deputy National Security Advisor during the Obama administration. Antony Blinken is the nominee for Secretary of State, and before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he vowed to restore American leadership on the world stage and work for what he called the greater good. Questions focused on how the new administration will deal with our allies, especially in Europe. Senator Bob Menendez also focusing on China.
When it comes to Iran, a couple of things. First, President-elect Biden is committed to the proposition that Iran will not acquire a nuclear weapon. And we share, I know, that goal across this this committee. An Iran with a nuclear weapon, or on the threshold of having one, with the capacity to build one on short order, would be an Iran that is even more dangerous than it already is when it comes to all of the other malicious activities that it's engaged in, whether it is support for terrorism, whether it is fueling and feeding its proxies, whether it is destabilizing the region. An Iran with a nuclear weapon or with the threshold capacity to build one is an Iran that would act potentially with even greater impunity than it already is. So I think we have an urgent responsibility to do whatever we can to prevent Iran from acquiring a record or getting a weapon or getting close to the capacity to having the fissile material to break out on short notice. In my judgment, the JCPOA, for whatever its limitations, was succeeding on its own terms in blocking Iran's pathways to producing fissile material for a nuclear weapon on short order. It also featured, and a feature that continues, the most intrusive inspections and monitoring regime in the history of arms control. The challenge we face now is that we pulled out of the agreement. Iran is now taking steps to undo the various constraints that were imposed on it by the agreement. And so it has increased its stockpile of low-enriched uranium. It is now enriching at a higher level. It is deploying centrifuges in ways that were prohibited under the agreement. The result is, based on public reporting, the breakout time, the time it would take Iran produce enough fissile material for one weapon has gone from beyond a year, as it was under the JCPOA, to about 3 or 4 months, based at least on public reporting. And that potentially brings us right back to the crisis point that we were reaching before the deal was negotiated. And so the president-elect believes that if Iran comes back into compliance, we would too. But we would use that as a platform with our allies and partners, who would once again be on the same side with us, to seek a longer and stronger agreement, and also, as you and the chairman have rightly pointed out, to capture these other issues, particularly with regard to missiles and Iran's destabilizing activities.
Antony Blinken's resume includes serving as the Deputy Secretary of State during the Obama administration. He was National Security Advisor to then Vice President Joe Biden, Democratic Staff Director on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and was part of the National Security Staff during the Clinton administration. Well, since 1796, when our first president left office, it's been a custom of sorts for the outgoing president to deliver a farewell address. Harry Truman became the first to deliver it on television January 15, 1953. And earlier today, President Trump releasing a 19-minute message via video, vowing that his movement that he started is only just beginning. Here's a portion of his taped remarks.
Now, as I prepare to hand power over to a new administration at noon on Wednesday, I want you to know that the movement we started is only just beginning. There's never been anything like it. The belief that a nation must serve its citizens will not dwindle, but instead only grow stronger by the day. As long as the American people hold in their hearts deep and devoted love of country, then there is nothing that this nation cannot achieve. Our communities will flourish. Our people will be prosperous. Our traditions will be cherished. Our faith will be strong. And our future will be brighter than ever before. I go from this majestic place with a loyal and joyful heart, an optimistic spirit, and a supreme confidence that for our country and for our children, the best is yet to come. Thank you and farewell. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
With more on the story, Jonathan Easley, national political reporter for TheHill.com. Let me begin with your reaction to this farewell address by President Trump. Certainly very different from what we've seen from his predecessors.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he doesn't mention Joe Biden by name in this address. He does say that, you know, this week we inaugurate a new administration and pray for its success in keeping America safe. He criticizes the siege on the Capitol and says it's not what the U.S. is about. But clearly those are two of the biggest things hanging over Trump's exit from the White House right now. Just questions about his role in the mob that stormed Capitol Hill, and then obviously his refusal to acknowledge Joe Biden as the victor.
And of course, the looming issue, likely the last official act as our 45th president, a series of pardons. What are you hearing this evening?
Yeah, that's right. Now, I mean, we don't know when these are coming. We've heard that they are coming, that he's been meeting with his senior advisors. Obviously, Jared Kushner, Ivanka Trump have played a central role in this. Could be dozens, could be up to 100. I mean, we've seen him use his pardon power before for just a real range of individuals. But a couple of the names that we keep seeing pop up. One is the rapper Lil Wayne, who's facing gun charges. There's the former assembly speaker in New York, a Democrat who's in prison right now, could get a pardon. Obviously, when you look at a question like this, you look at those surrounding Trump, his allies, his closest friends that are in potential legal peril, and then Trump himself. I mean, Trump is going to be leaving office facing potentially a wave of investigations from the Trump Organization and his business empire to his own political behavior while he was in office. What we're hearing is that Trump's lawyer, Pat Cipollone, has been steering him away from a self-pardon that seems unlikely at this point, and really there's questions about whether anything, something like that is even possible and how that would work. So that seems unlikely at this point. There's probably going to be a wave of pardons around low-level drug offenders that sort of keeps with the spirit of the president's criminal justice reform and his work with Alice Johnson that we've seen. But those will probably be overshadowed by some of the bigger names and the more controversial figures that could be in line for a pardon, whether it's Trump allies like Steve Bannon. I don't know if that's in the works or not, but that's someone that is definitely facing criminal charges that at one point had a relationship with the president. Obviously, advocates for Julian Assange are pressing for him to be pardoned. I don't know, again, if that's in the works or not, but certainly some of these potential for bigger names like someone like Lil Wayne is probably going to drown out some of the other names that are probably going to be involved with low-level drug offenders.
As the story continues to unfold, more details at TheHill.com. Jonathan Easley, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
In his resignation letter to President Trump, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar, taking aim at the 45th president, writing, quote, Unfortunately, the actions and rhetoric following the election, especially during this past week, threatened to tarnish these and other historic legacies of this administration. He went on to say the attacks on the Capitol were an assault on our democracy and the tradition of peaceful transitions of power that the United States of America first brought to the world. The outgoing HHS secretary also talked about the Trump administration's efforts to combat COVID-19 on a day in which the U.S. death toll surpassing 400,000.
Each life lost to COVID-19 is a tragedy that weighs on us all. During this difficult time, we are fortunate to have the chance to combat this unprecedented crisis. Through your daily work to save lives from the virus, to help patients get the care they need, and to support the health and well-being of all Americans. Thankfully, we have so many reasons for hope, and we know there is an end in sight. We have hope because of the incredible results delivered by our colleagues at HHS, elsewhere across the federal government, and in the private sector. Safe and effective vaccines that have been developed in record time and have now been administered to more than 14 million Americans, with nearly a million more doses being administered on average every day. We would not have these highly effective vaccines in substantial quantities if it were not for the work that so many of you have put into Operation Warp Speed. OWS built on the very early work done here at NIH and elsewhere with the development of the Moderna vaccine beginning here just over a year ago. We then married those remarkable scientific efforts to a set of capabilities from elsewhere in government and in the private sector. We drove early development and manufacturing by making pre-purchase commitments of more than $10 billion. We provided comprehensive support for vaccine manufacturing operations, enlisting private sector advisors and logistics experts from the Department of Defense to ensure that production could scale up without a hitch. DOD and ASPR bought the syringes, needles, and PPE needed to administer vaccines. And we ensured that no American would face any out-of-pocket costs for vaccination.
Those comments from outgoing HHS Secretary Alex Azar, who is stepping down as the new administration takes over at noon tomorrow. And former Attorney General Bill Barr, who left back in December, saying he was, quote, not surprised to see the Capitol Hill unrest nearly 2 weeks ago. In his first interview since the January 6th insurrection, the former AG saying that the debate over elections legitimacy led to the deadly riots. He spoke to the British network ITV.
Perhaps the debate about the integrity of the election was the final straw.
I think that was the thing that precipitated the riots on the Hill. Now, I think it's always important to remember that most people are exercising their First Amendment rights, but there was a substantial group, obviously, that went far beyond that and broke into the Capitol and tried to interfere with the proceedings, and that's unacceptable. I'm sad to see, but not surprised in a way, to see the kind of violence we saw on Capitol Hill. I consider it despicable, and I was not Attorney General. I had already left office when that occurred. But I felt that they should move very quickly to disperse that crowd, regardless of which side of the political spectrum is involved. We just cannot tolerate violence interfering with the processes of government.
That from the former Attorney General Bill Barr on Britain's ITV. At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow gaining 116 points, the NASDAQ rose nearly 200, the S&P was up 30. And finally, in a Today Show interview, it was first daughter to first daughter. In a conversation led by Jeb Bush, she talked to Ashley Biden about what life might be like the next 4 years as her dad becomes the 46th president.
The transfer of power from one president to another typically involves a handoff at the White House, including a tea and tour visit with the first ladies. I asked Ashley whether this was happening in an interview later with her nieces.
Has your mom heard from Melania Trump about doing the traditional protocols?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're doing the traditional protocol, which is unfortunate, but I think we're all okay with it.
As the next first daughter, Ashley brings a career of public service, working for years as a social worker and public advocate.
The role of first daughter is one without a guidebook or rules. You don't run for election. Right. How do you see that playing out for you?
Well, I will not have a job with the administration. I will, however, hopefully use this platform to advocate for social justice, for mental health, to be involved in community development and revitalization. I do hope to bring awareness and education to some topics, subjects that are, you know, really important.
Ashley Biden is the president-elect's daughter. The NBC News interview aired this morning on the Today program. It was conducted by Jenna Bush. Of course, she is President George W. Bush's daughter. A reminder, live coverage all day tomorrow on the C-SPAN networks, the inauguration of our 46th president. And you can follow it on the website at cspan.org. I'm Steve Scully in Washington. We thank you for listening.